The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
And from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
It was the mid-1990s. Gail McWilliam Jelly had a new job working for the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. Part of the job was to meet up with farmers and find out what kind of challenges they were facing and how the state might be able to help.
I was new here and talking with farmers about things they would like to see happen in the marketing end of things. Heard a lot from farmers that they would love to be able to sell to restaurants.
That was a new idea then. Restaurants were not buying food from local farms, but having it shipped through big, efficient national distributors. Sure, New Hampshire has a lot of little farms and even a few bigger operations, but it's not the Midwest. You couldn't go to a restaurant and get a salad with New Hampshire greens.
And so we attempted to have sort of a matchmaking meeting, if you will. We invited restaurants to come and farmers to come. And we got a lot of farmers to come and not a whole lot of restaurants at that point in time.
Farmers had a pretty clear reason to come to the table. They wanted more ways to put their food on people's plates. And if it could stay right here in the state, all the better. So why weren't restaurants biting?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously the producer end of it was looking for that opportunity. And maybe the demand wasn't out there yet from the consumer looking for the local experience. But for whatever reason, the restaurants weren't looking for that or weren't ready for that.
20 years later, you walk around Manchester, Nashua, Portsmouth, or Concord, and you'll be dodging sidewalk chalkboards, hawking local ciders, squashes, and cheeses, and throwing around the hard-to-define term farm-to-table on menus and ads. So what changed? I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. A listener submitted a question for our Only in New Hampshire series. What is going on with the farm-to-table movement in New Hampshire? How can you tell what's just advertising flair and what is real local food? Producer Ben Henry dug into this question for us. In fact, Ben, you jumped on it. Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, the local food movement in general in this country is in a pretty weird moment right now. It kind of already had its heyday, and now it's just here to stay. And it's grown to such an extent, and it's so widespread that we have all these marketing gimmicks that are deeply entrenched that are now very familiar, that we're used to being sold local food, which makes it hard as consumers to distinguish what is just a marketing gimmick apart from what is real, authentic local food.
Right. You can see fast food restaurants advertising local food. But it sounds like the listener who submitted the question was pretty skeptical, too.
Right. And that's why I wanted to look into this. I don't know. I mean, do you ever feel suspicious of local food, or is that just me?
Yeah. Local to where, I guess, is the question I ask.
Yeah, like, you know, you're going out to a restaurant and they've got their chalkboard and they've got the, like, crate slats on the wall. So I think something about the fact that there is a whole aesthetic that comes with this is like a red flag to me, because it lets you know you're being sold something. And whenever I get that feeling like someone's trying to sell something to me, I just get a little bit cagey. I would just want to know more is all.
Well, that's what makes you a good reporter. So where'd you start?
So the first thing I did was I wanted to talk with people who know exactly how local food distribution, specifically in New Hampshire, works. So I kind of went back to where it all started. I sat down with Gail McWilliam Jelly, who you just heard from at the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture. She's now the head of agricultural development, but back in the early 2000s or so, she was part of a small group of people that sort of built the foundation for local food in New Hampshire. So you helped create something called the New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant Connection. Can you tell me where that started?
Yeah, that started in around 2004. And there were a group of us having a meeting and talking about what we could do to further opportunities for farmers, particularly with restaurants.
This was a small group, a dozen or so people. Farmers, chefs, dietitians, local food advocates, all people who wanted, for one reason or another, to improve the food that the rest of us were eating.
that group is was the genesis for the Farm to Restaurant Connection, and we decided we would move forward with some kind of a organized effort to connect farmers and restaurants. In that, you know, we settled on a name, the Farm to Restaurant Connection. We developed a logo. We created fact sheets and all of that kind of stuff. So we formalized it from that particular effort.
And what was the first thing you guys tried in terms of getting people in touch with each other about local food?
We felt like, because of the sort of the failure of early efforts to bring groups together to have a meeting, we felt like sort of illustrating the value of local foods was the way to go. And we decided on a concept that we called have a grower's dinner, where we would encourage restaurants to host an event, and everything on the menu for that event would be from New Hampshire, from, you know, from appetizers to dessert. And we would help to make the connections for those restaurants who might not have ever, you know, reached out to local producers, to help them make the connections with the products, and then the chefs could be as creative as they wanted with the foods. And we ended up with some really fun events.
There's a lot of hidden infrastructure required to bring local food to a restaurant that I think a lot of people don't necessarily know or think about. So what kind of work did you guys have to do at that time when there wasn't local food available in most restaurants in order to make those growers' dinners happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we often had to twist arms to get restaurants to participate. There was some education involved so that people understood what we were trying to accomplish. That part of it, that sometimes took a couple of meetings, and then we had to explain to people, you know, who was in their area as far as resources for the products, and often we were driving to the farms and getting the product and bringing it to the restaurant. Or the farmers would also participate in that as well, and sometimes the chef would go get the stuff and bring it, because that distribution infrastructure was weaker then. It's still not the best, but it's definitely better than it was back then.
So it was something that it sounds like a few chefs were thinking about, but it was not something that was widespread, that all chefs were thinking, yeah, we need to go local, and I just wish I could.
That's right. And, you know, like I said, the distribution channels were not as great back then. And so a lot of restaurants were used to making one call to one distributor and have everything, as one of my colleagues would say, from light bulbs to steak, you know, show up in the delivery. So to carry local foods or to use local foods was a little more effort. They had to, you know, call this farm for chicken and this farm for tomatoes. And, you know, that just takes a little more logistical time.
What do you think you guys learned from this sort of experiment in putting restaurants in touch with farmers?
Well, I think we learned that the illustrative aspect of it was a successful way to promote the concept. Early on, we were asking restaurants, you know, in some case, pleading with restaurants to hold these events. After the first year or two, people were coming to us and asking if they could host an event.
Nationwide, the idea of local food was catching on. And now, someone in New Hampshire had proven that it could work here. But when it comes down to actually shopping for food, figuring out what farm-to-table means is complicated.
To actually come and see and try and taste and smell and be in this environment, I think it's important for all of us.
What you're hearing is an ad from a big food corporation, really big.
Vinegar, eggs, and canola oil.
Beautiful.
And those are three adorable children describing the ingredients to, yeah, mayonnaise. Anything sounds healthy with folksy music in the background. A New Hampshire law defines local food as being food from within the borders of New Hampshire. But that law was written before the phrase farm to table was popular. So fast food chains and big agriculture can throw around the same language and imagery in their ads without many restrictions. To be clear, this isn't totally new. Food packaging has been adorned with smiling farmers and green pastures for ages. And companies always play to whatever health trend is popular at the moment. Farm to table is just another idea that's been ingested into the mainstream. Still, this changed the meaning of the term farm to table. If it wasn't a buzzword already, now it is. Even with small restaurants, distinguishing marketing gimmicks from authentic food is a problem. A place might bill itself as farm to table, but does that mean that one of the ingredients on your plate came from a nearby farm, or all of them? And how close does that farm have to be local? You start to realize if a company really wants to lie to you or just bend the truth about the food it's serving you, it probably can. Gail and the others over at the Farm to Restaurant Connection realized this was a problem, and they had an idea. They thought, let's be the referee. Let's go to restaurants that say they're local, ask them about what they serve, and grade them on how much they are actually supporting local farms. Rochelle Lyons was still in college at Plymouth State when the Farm to Restaurant Connection asked her to design this system. She's now a professor there at Plymouth.
The term local or farm to table can be used in a lot of ways that are very subjective. And we really wanted to create some objective criteria that would define for the consumer, what does it really mean to visit this restaurant that is certified as a local New Hampshire restaurant?
Here's what they came up with. They made a point system. You got local produce at your restaurant, you get some points. Specifically, anywhere from 2 to 10 points, depending on how much and how often you have produce. Got local meat? Another 2 to 10 points for you.
And we really explored what are the fundamental pieces of being a New Hampshireite that would need to be reflected in the certification program.
Seafood, dairy, maple, honey, beer, all these things can net you some points with Rochelle. Restaurants that have lots of variety in their local products and can offer them consistently, they wind up with a lot of points in this system. So it's a way of distinguishing restaurants that just have one local thing every once in a while from restaurants that really commit to serving local food. I should say also, this was a totally voluntary process. Rochelle and company were not showing up like a SWAT team and shaming restaurants that did not buy local. In fact, so far only 15 restaurants have volunteered to be certified. So it's not a comprehensive survey of all the local food in the state. At the end of the day, it's a window sticker. It's a way for chefs to say that they passed the test.
It is a little tricky to have a 100% local dish all the time. We don't produce a lot of olive oil here in New Hampshire, but we certainly love olive oil in our dishes. But our certification program is really designed with the intention of inviting chefs and farmers to establish relationships, inviting consumers to begin to explore where their food comes from.
By the way, you can find a list of all the restaurants that passed the certification process at nhfarmtorestaurant.com. On a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you think you're achieving the goals of the certification program?
If I had to put a number on it, I would say a 7. And the challenge is that New Hampshire Farm to Restaurant Connection is an all-volunteer organization.
The Farm to Restaurant Connection can only do so much, and they're no longer doing things like the growers' dinners, those events to promote local food. But there is somebody doing something very similar to the growers' dinners.
I am Keith Saracen. I'm the founder and chef at the Farmers Dinner, and we run farm-to-table events all over New England.
The Farmers Dinner that Keith runs is really similar to the idea that Gail and her colleagues had 15 years ago. They host events to showcase local food. And Keith is all about not just supporting local farms, but cooking up New Hampshire food in a way that tastes good.
All the words we encounter, like farm to table and local and organic, those words feel like they've become really opaque. And that must be something that you encounter a lot as somebody who works with a lot of restaurants and chefs and farmers who market their stuff using these buzzwords.
It is probably one of the things that annoys me the most. You know, going to a restaurant and a restaurant will say, hey, we're a farm-to-table restaurant, and maybe their salad, you know, has used hydroponic, locally grown greens. It's not to say hydroponic is bad, but it's still perpetuating the disconnect between that chef and then the farm itself. Supporting local has a lot more to do with than just purchasing. For instance, getting to know the needs of the farmers, getting to know the cycles of growing is part of the way that you can, you know, ostracize yourself from that marketing genre and jargon that's really been spewed upon the average consumer.
I think there's also a suspicion out there that when we see big companies co-opting the language of organic food, I think there's a suspicion that the idea behind local food is great, but maybe we've gone too far. We've gone a little bit overboard. Maybe it's become too much of a fad. Is that hard for you to see that in the world?
It is, and it is when we start pointing fingers at the problem. And the problem isn't corporations. The problem starts with understanding that us as a consumer, we hold power. And if we want to vote for a corporation by continuing to support that, that's okay. But just understand that that's where our power lies. We cannot point the finger and blame people because, to be honest, there's no blaming Monsanto, there's no blaming McDonald's. It starts with you taking your personal responsibility and power back. And if you go to a local farm, you're making a statement that I want to support a community. And when you do support a local farm, your money goes back into that community. And to me, that's a nice way of voting.
On the other hand, economically, it's not easy. We are in a state that seasonally, we only have certain products available at any given time, and there is a lot of stuff that consumers expect to have that we want to have all year round. And there are much larger companies that are providing those things. Does it ever feel like you are walking against a headwind when you're doing this?
In the beginning, it did. It's hard to replace citrus. But instead of looking at that as a problem, I decided to look, what are the actual solutions? So before us, before the age of trucks shipping food all over the world, what did we do? And there's a beauty in understanding that in June, the first strawberries come up. And it's an amazing feeling to walk into a farm, pick a strawberry, not having it the entire year, and to taste that for the first time when it's warm, and you feel the summer sun beating against that. Those are indelible memories, and if you were to have access to every single solitary thing you wanted throughout the course of the year, it becomes mundane.
Well, thank you for putting up with my pessimistic line of questioning.
It's my pleasure.
You know that early scene from Portlandia that's been referred to a lot when two people sit down in a restaurant and the person waiting on them tells them what's on the menu and they ask about the chicken and they get in a car and drive to the farm where the chicken was?
Mm-hmm. That was my reporting process for this piece.
So short of driving to a farm, what do you suggest?
Well, I asked Keith what his advice is for consumers who just want to know what they're buying. He said, first of all, it's really not that hard in New Hampshire to just meet your local farmers and to show up at their farms. We have farmers markets all over the place all the time. You can go directly to farms. That really isn't actually that hard. And the other thing you can do is just ask a lot of questions when you're at the restaurant. I mean, if you ask, they will tell you. So you can, with a little bit of effort, you can actually find out a lot about where your food is coming from.
But do you want to be that person at the restaurant is saying, okay, and what was the pig fed?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. New England artistry is steeped in history. There are the idyllic oil paintings of covered bridges, white clapboard meeting houses, and snow-brushed white mountains. Not to mention the traditional crafts associated with the region, the wood carvers and stonewall builders and potters. I should say that's not the sort of stuff you'll find at the Wrong Brain Bazaar in Newmarket.
All right, so I make my art with hand-cut paper. I use a scalpel knife, and I cut paper, and then each color I layer together to make my image.
I scour the globe looking for really weird items to make into jewelry.
I'm a graffiti artist of about 12 years.
Sure, I make colored clay, hand-built ceramics.
I make pins, I do some vintage clothes, I make light switch covers, lots of rock and roll stuff.
Wrong Brain is an art collective that makes zines, throws shows and events, and provides a private studio and community workspace in Dover, New Hampshire. In early December, they held their annual gift market called the Holiday Bazaar. The event was in the wide-open basement of an office building. A couple dozen artists crowded their wares onto tables and chatted with passersby about their work. Some were veterans of the bazaar. For some, this was the very first time anyone had ever given them a table and let them sell their artwork.
Wrong Brain's fantastic because it brings together such a good group of people that all support each other and support the arts and make it affordable and welcome to everybody.
They're very inclusive. You'll have someone that just started out that can have a table here, and there's some veterans.
I grew up in Dover, and I never felt like we would ever have this kind of artistic community to begin with. I thought I was going to have to travel to the big city in order to find something like this.
The event provided crowded, somewhat clamoring proof that New Hampshire's makers are not limited to landscapes, wooden spoons, and the more quiet arts. To find out how Wrong Brain went from homemade zine to full-on community art space, producer Ben Henry sat down with the founder of Wrong Brain, Sam Pellini, at their headquarters in Dover.
Okay, so this is headquarters.
A stripped-down open space that smells like paint and plaster.
So where did this all start?
Wrong Brain first originated at Exeter High School. It started as an after-school art club because I was desiring more from art education than I was getting in school. I had a really great art teacher, but it was very traditional. So I wanted to share and collaborate with my peers and also learn more about subcultures and underground art. So I just started making posters and hanging them up, and we would just kind of hang out and read Juxtapose magazine and watch anime and do collage and that kind of thing. And then after that, it took a hiatus. Wrong Brain is all about the hiatus.
The creative hiatus.
The creative hiatus. So I went to Massachusetts College of Art for 2 years, dropped out, went back to Exeter, and became a full-time baker, and then started a zine, which I called Wrong Brain.
Can you, just occurred to me, some people might not be familiar with zines. Can you give me a taxonomy? What is a zine? And say more about why you love that form.
Okay. So a zine is a self-published booklet. Usually it's computer paper size, folded in half and stapled, normally black and white Xerox. You know, people get more artsy with them. There's, silk screened versions and risograph and linoleum printed, full color booklets. There's big ones, small ones. But the most important part about them is that they're self-published. So you do the whole layout yourself. You take them to the copier yourself. And you have something that you want to put out into the world. And so you make a zine about it.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to make you be the ambassador of zines.
I'm always ambassador of zines.
I assume you don't mind. And tell me more about that period. How many people would usually be involved? And what type of work were you looking for? And what type of work were people coming to you with?
We would have anywhere between, 15 and 25 contributors to each zine. And it was normally things that couldn't or wouldn't be published anywhere else. So we were really about the heart of the underground and the darker parts of, the psyche. And also emerging art and, people who were just submitting their art or showing their art or their writing for the very first time. And that's what we were all about. And it caught on quickly because there wasn't a whole lot of other underground stuff going on in Exeter area. And a childhood friend of my sister and brother, Cody LaPlante, who was studying poetry at UNH at the time, was really into the zine. And he had submitted and immediately wanted to be involved. So he became the writing editor. And then he really propelled the zine for years because I would get burnt out and I'd be like, I'm moving on to something else. And, he would come back around and be like, we got to do a zine. I'm going to be in town. We're going to make a zine, Sam. I'm like, okay.
And as you were at that period looking around at the artistic community around you in, the Dover area, the Exeter area, and just New England in general, what were you seeing that was missing in mainstream art?
In terms of mainstream art and the traditional gallery scene, it's very much consumer-minded. You're creating this product that you want somebody to buy. And with zines, because we always give them away for free, you don't need to have that in the forefront of your mind when you're creating. So it was a lot of very personal content that we were publishing that, there was no reason for it besides just they wanted to get that off their chest. And I think that's probably what was missing from the arts community.
you kind of slowly transitioned from being something that there wasn't a lot of money involved and a lot of money changing hands. But now you do have a more formal organization. You have a website, you have a space that everybody's paying rent for. Mm-hmm. So what was that transition like, and how did that happen?
So that transition is it's a sad one. Before we had the space, there was no money. Every time we wanted to publish a zine, we would just go around and ask people for money. We would say, you know, we'll put your name in the back of the zine if you give us $50. And we would put our own money into it too. And then, you know, have the zine release party where hopefully from the door we can make a little bit back. In 2015, Cody, who is my partner and the writing editor, died from a heroin overdose. And his family asked that people in his memoriam donate to Wrong Brain. We started getting all these checks that were made out to Wrong Brain, but we weren't a legitimate organization. So it kind of forced us to legitimize and become a registered nonprofit with New Hampshire. So from that, we decided to get a space because it was something that we needed. We were running out of opportunities in Dover, and we really wanted a place that we could call headquarters.
I just imagine that was incredibly hard to go through.
It was, and it was like, it was just ridiculous because, you know, even in his death, he's still propelling the whole organization forward. It was just, it was a lot, but I mean, what else can you do besides like take his honor and his creativity and ingenuity and like, and his ambition and like just keep going with it. And now we have this huge, amazing thing that was really all thanks to him. You know, I don't know if his picture's hanging up there on the other side of the door, but like Cody's always central to Wrong Brain.
You said something really interesting, which is that when you are publishing with the consumer in mind, that affects the kind of art that you make. Mm-hmm. What has it meant for people when you can give them that opportunity to be published?
I've heard from quite a few of our contributors that it's been inspiring and motivating. It's like a small, it's like a little stepping stone. Like if you want to go off and do bigger and better things, like submitting to a zine is a really good first step.
What do you tell someone when they have something that they've created and they kind of want to take that step, but they're just terrified?
I'll always say you should absolutely do it. There's nothing like the feeling of having your work in a booklet that like a stranger is reading. And it is terrifying, but it's also liberating in that sense. So, you know, even if you need to be anonymous to do that, you should still send it out into the world. You'll feel better. And you know what? Someone else can have a connection to your story that could be really important for them and could change their life.
That was Sam Pollini, founder of Wrong Brain, speaking with Ben Henry. To find more about Wrong Brain, check out some photos and find out about upcoming events. Go to wordofmouthradio.org. And we need your help on something that we're putting together. Over the past few months, our team has had a lot of conversations about the sexual assault allegations increasingly coming from all corners of the American workplace. We talked about what happens and why we think it does and about our own experiences. What's missing from the conversation is you. This is a show about New Hampshire, and we're asking those of you who are inclined to join that conversation. You can send an email to metoo@nhpr.org with whatever level of description of your story feels comfortable, your age, and where you're from. We truly appreciate the sensitive nature of this subject, and sending us an email will not commit you to talking with us on the record or to making your story public. But if moved to do so, thank you for helping us explore a critical issue for our time and for our state. That's metoo@nhpr.org. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth and a conversation with the National Book Award-winning poet, Frank Bidart, right after the break. This is NHPR. Frank Bidart first announced himself as a bold, shockingly original poet by writing in the voice of a psychopath. The first poem of his first book was called Herbert White, and it provided a glimpse into the mind of a child murderer and necrophiliac. Here's Frank Bidart reading from Herbert White.
And I saw under me a little girl was just lying there in the mud. And I knew I couldn't have done that. Somebody else had to have done that.
Like so many young gay kids, Frank's longing was to escape the straight, masculine stereotypes that surrounded him. He was born in 1939 in Bakersfield, California, where he and his mother both felt boxed in by the town's macho cowboy culture and formed a close but tense relationship. Frank upset that bond when he went to college and discovered a love of literature and poetry. His mother never left. Bedart confronts his early doubt and denial in the 2013 poem, Queer.
Lie to yourself about this, and you will forever lie about everything. Everybody already knows everything, so you can lie to them. That's what they want. But lie to yourself. What you will lose is yourself. Then you turn into them. For each gay kid whose adolescence was America in the 40s or 50s, the primary, the crucial scenario forever is coming out or not, or not, or not, or not, or not. Involuted velleities of self-erasure. Quickly after my parents died, I came out. Foundational narrative designed to confer existence. If I had managed to come out to my mother, she would have blamed not me, but herself. The door through which you were shoved out into the light was self-loathing and terror. Thank you, terror. You learned early that adults' genteel fantasies about human life were not for you, life. You think sex is a knife driven into you to teach you that.
That's Frank Bedart reading Queer last month at the Capital Center of the Arts in Concord, where NHPR presented him with the Donald Hall Jane Kenyon Prize in American Poetry. Just a week before that, Frank Bedart won a National Book Award for Half Light, Collected Poems, 1965 to 2016, a dazzling compendium of his published works, along with a new sequence called Thirst. After reading a few poems from Half Light at the ceremony in Concord, Frank Bedart joined me in front of a live audience to talk about his work. Bedart wrote openly about being gay in his second collection, The Book of the Body, in the 1970s. I asked him if revealing his sexuality felt brave at the time.
You know, I had to. It was either that or be mute. And I didn't want to be mute. And in that sense, it wasn't brave because it was a way of continuing to be alive as a writer. Mm. I had to write those poems.
How was that different, writing about the experience of being queer in 2013 and back then in the 60s, 70s rather?
I think the subject matter of that poem, Queer, was a subject matter I'd been brooding about since I was five. As I say, I wrote about being gay earlier, but I think I addressed it more directly when I became older. Mm. I don't think I entirely understand that process. It felt good to be able to finally write a poem called Queer. You know, I think there's this process of, I think often happens with minorities, of a term is hurled at you which you hate and resist, and then finally you accept it as a kind of badge of honor. Mm-hmm. And I think the word queer is like that.
Lie to yourself about this.
And you will lie to yourself for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And really, and there's no alternative. I think there's no alternative. I am not telling anyone who lies to other people about that, what it amounts to, because I can't begin to judge somebody else's life. But if you lie to yourself about that, you're lost. You become unreal to yourself. And nothing is worth that. Nothing.
You came out after both of your parents had died, right?
Yes, and I think if my mother had lived longer, I would have come out to her. I know one reason I didn't, and I don't know if you can remember this. There was a period in the 40s, 50s, that still hung on in the 60s, where if a boy in particular was gay, it was ascribed to their parents. The parents had done something wrong, particularly the mother. The mother had been too strong, dominant, whatever. And I know my mother would have said not that something was wrong with me or that nothing was wrong. She would have said that she had been a bad mother, that she had failed. And I didn't want to put that on her, and I don't see it in that way. Half-light. That crazy drunken night I maneuvered you out into a field outside of Coachella. I'd never seen a sky so full of stars, as if the dirt of our lives still were sprinkled with glistening white shells from the ancient seabed beneath us that receded long ago. Parallel. We lay in parallel furrows. That suffocated, fearful look on your face. Jim, yesterday I heard your wife on the phone tell me you died almost 9 months ago. Jim, now we cannot ever. Bitter that we cannot ever have the conversation that in nature and alive we never had. Now, not ever. We have not spoken in years. I thought perhaps at 90 or 100, two broken down old men, we wouldn't give a damn and find speech. When I tell you that all the years we were undergraduates, I was madly in love with you. You say you knew. I say I knew you knew. You say there was no place in nature we could meet. You say this as if you need me to admit something. No place in nature given our natures? Or is this warning? I say what is happening now is happening only because one of us is dead. You laugh and say, or both of us. Our words will be weirdly jolly. That light I now envy exists only on this page.
I'm Virginia Prescott talking with the National Book Award-winning poet Frank Bidart. Our conversation was recorded live at the Hall Kenyon Poetry Awards in Concord, New Hampshire. I want to ask you more about your mother. Each of us hungry beyond belief.
Right.
You said, what was your mother hungry for?
Oh, God. She was hungry for an embodiment in the world that represented her. The myth that I grew up in the middle of was that she and my father loved each other more than anyone. but they could not remain together because my father was alcoholic and a womanizer, and she could not stay married to him, but that he loved her more than anyone and she loved him more than anyone. That was a myth that she clung to until he remarried finally, and suddenly that didn't seem to be the case. It was part of a breakdown she had. She wanted an embodiment in the world of her spirit. I think everybody wants that. They want something to represent who they are inside. Unfortunately, the closest thing she had was me. I had all the sensibility and articulateness, and I think stood for the way she saw her own inner life. And I could not remain mainly her son. I had to have a life of my own. And she found that intolerable.
So many of your poems are about things that are said and unsaid. I wonder, did you actually have those conversations with your mother? Did she understand that?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was terrible. I would go home to Bakersfield twice a year for 3 or 4 days, and I could pretend that everything was okay and that our relations were amicable. And yet I would have to, in a way that I'm ashamed of, I had to explode at least once during my 3-day trip, which is to say I could lie and pretend that everything was hunky-dory, and yet some part of my psyche couldn't lie. And then we would have a reconciliation, and she would say she was sorry, and I would say I was sorry, and that everything was fine. This was never resolved.
Well, it strikes me that you talked about these explosive reunions twice a year with your mom, and yet the poem Half Light about Jim, the stuff you never talked about,
right?
The things you could never say.
Right.
So there's this kind of, and I see this in a lot of your poems, there's this kind of urgency, and then there's this kind of calmness.
Well, I think this has to do with the nature of art. Art is the place that the things that never happen in nature and perhaps cannot happen in nature can happen. You know, I can have that conversation with Jim that I never had.
Yeah.
I can have a conversation with my mother that I never had. I can see more complicatedly my relationship with my father in a way that I could not embody in real life. I think that is one function of art. It is a place where things that in nature can't meet can meet and achieve a kind of, if not equilibrium or peace, achieve their own nature and necessity and exist in a kind of balance or suspension and tension than they can in reality.
It's kind of exactly what the therapist would tell you not to do, have conversations with the person who is not in the room. And I wonder if this is a way to work something out.
I think my therapist never told me that.
Okay. But, you know, that idea of imagine conversations.
Right.
Does this ever push you to have those conversations in real life, thinking about this?
Well, of course I tried. I mean, but, well, first of all, Jim died. And then when I tried to have these conversations with my mother, they would always end up with a false affirmation that everything was fine because she needed to believe everything was fine and that there was no problem and that we simply loved each other. I think, you know, one of the fundamental facts about human experience is that we love and hate the same thing. And people find that very hard to accept. They don't want that to be true. But in art, the ways in which you both love and hate can be present and not destroy each other.
Excerpts there from my conversation with the National Book Award winner, Frank Bidart. NHBR presented the Hall Kenyon Poetry Prize to Bidart in November. He's now 78 and lives alone in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and teaches at Wellesley College. We thought we'd finish off with excerpts from a more recent poem called Visions at 74.
The planet turns there without you. Beautiful. Exiled by death, you cannot touch it. Weird joy to watch postulates lived out and discarded. Something crowded inside us, always craving to become something glistening outside us. The relentless planet showing itself the logic of what is buried inside it.
Word of Mouth was produced this week by Ben Henry. Senior producer is Taylor Quimby. Our staff includes Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Justin Paradise. Special thanks to NHPR's Sarah Plourd, Andrew Perella, and Patricia McLaughlin for their work on the Hall Kenyon Poetry event, along with Michael Herman and Elizabeth Jewell from Gibson's Bookstore, and Viv Lewine, Lynn Sabian, and Steve Martin at the Capital Center for the Arts. The Chicago Humanities Festival kindly gave us permission to use audio of Frank Bedard reading Herbert White. So, thanks, guys. Maureen McMurray is director of A Field Outside of Coachella. And if you celebrate Christmas, all of us here at Word of Mouth wish you a merry one. Next week, we'll be boozing it up on Word of Mouth, answering as many questions as we can about the state's liquor laws. So join us for that. But for now, stick around. Civics 101 is coming up right after the break.